This morning, and I've been looking forward to sharing some important thoughts with you. I bring greetings from Mission Boulevard Baptist Church in Fayetteville, Arkansas, and Brother Hudson and I have been friends for many years, and it's good to see Sister Margaret, good to see Brother Joseph and his wife and family, and let's see, Brother Bob Thompson, and there's probably some others. I may be forgetting somebody here, but it's good to see everybody. I've been tasked with a responsibility this morning to equip you, not to just tell you, but to equip you with some answers that will make your evangelism effective. As disciples, we are tasked by God Himself to be ambassadors to the world. And that means we're supposed to be carrying the message of the gospel of Jesus Christ, which is a salvation message to save souls. We're supposed to be taking that message and communicating that message effectively to the world. Now, if we were to take a poll here, I say, how many are feel really adequate to do a good job of soul winning and making disciples? Well, I'm not going to ask you to do that. Okay, see, some of you are smiling about that for good reason. Well, how many of us can actually say that we feel adequate or sufficient? It's more like Moses standing there in front of the bush. Well, who am I, Lord? I can't do this. But you know, that's where we can count on the blessings of God and His empowerment, His presence to pick up the slack where we lack. And so what we want to do is look a little bit here, just a couple of statements for context of what we're faced with and why we need to have some good answers for people asking questions today. Most of you are probably familiar you're familiar with the phrase, well, Toto, we're not in Kansas anymore. There you go. We are not in the same America right now. That has been known even 10 years ago. And a lot less than 20 years ago and so on. We're not in the same culture. The culture has changed on us, and we are going through a process right now of being marginalized as Christians and really being alienated. And as I demonstrated yesterday and the night before, Friday night, we are in an inescapable conflict, a war that has an inevitable and predictable outcome. It has to be that way. Ultimately, we will find ourselves cast out of Sodom and Gomorrah. It's just that dangerous. That's the trend right now. I'm not exaggerating that. And if you didn't hear that Friday night, you can get the tape and listen to that. But we have an insidious enemy that we're all familiar with. We're fighting that old serpent, the devil, Lucifer, Satan. And he has a goal in mind, and that is to blind the hearts and minds of them, lest they should hear the light of the glorious gospel. He's putting up every kind of roadblock imaginable. He's trying to block us mentally as well as physically and intellectually from hearing and understanding the gospel message that will save souls. Now, that is not only a roadblock for the lost, but it is a roadblock for us as well. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that this evening as far as the roadblocks in our own minds. But like I said, my task this morning is to equip you with some answers. How many came here? Now, you can show your hands here. How many came here anticipating hearing some answers this morning to some really hard questions? Oh, that is wonderful. Great. Now, see, teaching at a university with college students, and the way I do it, I usually start a Bible study open session. In fact, some lessons last all semester. And what that means is, It's a free-for-all. Come and get your questions answered. You bring your questions, and my strategy is always, I'm going to answer your questions before we start into my Bible study. How's that? And so you never know what you're going to hear, and students will come, and they will bring their toughest questions. And what I discovered was oftentimes they'll ask the same question over and over and over again. And why is that? Well, I went through that experience myself. Every Friday afternoon with our pastor, my pastor now, he was teaching a Revelation study, and I averaged about 20 questions a week. And I always kept a little piece of paper at the back of my Bible, and I'd be reading during the week and studying and thinking. And then I'd write down questions, and I averaged about 20 questions. And after the Revelation study, every Friday afternoon, I said, well, Brother Brian, I have some more questions. And we'd lay it out, and he and I would go through the whole list every Friday afternoon. And that was very important to me. I enjoyed the Revelation study, but, man, I had questions that needed to get answered, and I kept asking a lot of the same questions over and over again. I was having difficulty retaining the answers. And that's why repetition is not a bad thing. And when you tell someone something, don't worry about them asking that question again. It's not a surprise. We live in a world that's literally designed like a vacuum cleaner, a mental vacuum cleaner by the God of this world. And He is sucking information out of our minds, clouding our understanding, and creating a darkness of the heart and mind, lest we should hear and understand and be able to use the gospel message. And it's not only the lost that's being affected, it is the saved being affected as well. Now, in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, which most of you could probably answer, or could quote, it says, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Now, do you believe that God actually created the heaven and the earth? All right, we got amens. Okay, let's hear some omies. Okay, good. I know my audience now. I know who I'm talking to. Or you don't want to admit it yet. All right. Now, how do you know? How are you sure that God actually created the heaven and the earth? What makes that knowable to you? Well, okay, someone's going to say something? All right, the Word of God. All right, the Word of God tells you, but there are a lot of other books you can read that tell you that it happened by accident. There was a big explosion, everything came into being. So, this is a very, very important answer, and what I'm about to show you is very important. What is the difference between reading it in the Bible and reading it in another book? It's just written down. Somebody wrote it. You see it in black and white, print on white paper, and it could be either book. So I ask you, what makes your certainty more certain than an evolutionist who says it just happened by accident? He's reading black and white print on white paper. You're reading black and white print on paper. So what's the difference? The what? The author. All right. So you say it's the author, but Dr. So-and-so with a PhD and this and that, maybe 5 or 6 PhDs, studied this very carefully, and a great physicist understands and can explain how everything came to be by accident. Now, what is the difference between your author that I can't see and the author I can see who has all the credentials that can verify that he knows what he's talking about? How can I know for sure that your author is more credible than another author? You got to prove it. How do you prove that your author is more credible than the one with the PhD? The unseen author, whom I cannot hold in my hand. I do not see his credentials. How do I know that? Nothing he says is proven wrong. And yet, there's a contradiction between Dr. Evolution and the God of the Bible. They're contradicting each other right there. And Dr. Evolution is parading fossils. He's parading credentials. He's offering explanation. He's showing that the stars and planets are moving outward as though everything exploded, and we see this outward motion continuing. He's got the redshift phenomenon. Lots of evidence to back up his claims. What do I have other than the author of the Bible saying, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth? So what's the evidence here? I see the evidence here with Dr. Evolution, but where's the evidence that this author is correct? All right. What is the evidence that the author of the Bible was here? I mean, it's one thing to say it, but how do we know he was here? Okay. All right. All right. First and second law. So someone's drawing on information from yesterday. Now, what that is evidence of what can't be, but it's still relying. Are we confident and sure, just as confident and sure as Dr. Evolution, we're presenting evidence from the physical world? Can you really be certain of what you can taste, touch, and smell and measure and reason out in your own mind? Is that really something you can rely on? Because ultimately you're relying on your own mind, your own skills, your own level of education to be able to derive a conclusion from the laws of thermodynamics. So, Brother Joseph, going back to you, since you started all this, let's ask you, you said you are confident. Oh, you didn't say it? Oh, who did? Brother Sammy, okay, all right, now we got the right culprit here. We'll lay blame where it belongs. All right, so Brother Sammy, we got to go back to you, Brother Joseph. You haven't said anything yet. That's what you're saying. Okay, now here's your opportunity. So Brother Joseph, how is it that you know for sure? I guess you know for sure you didn't say it yet. You sure God created everything? All right. How can you be so certain? Oh, but I just said Dr. Evolution's got redshift phenomena. He's got the planets and stars moving away as though just like the Big Bang would predict. So he's got evidence to support his theory. So he does have evidence. Well, he is giving the evidence right there. He is giving the evidence that such an event has taken place. You see, it's not completely empty and void of evidence. Okay, now what I'm doing here is showing you what goes on in a college classroom, or what goes on in a science classroom, or maybe even a history class. This is the sort of thing that I faced as a college student when I was a freshman, in which the college professor is debating the student. And we have the Bible. Well, now, what just happened was I am demanding evidence and putting you on my playing field, my level of evidence to verify what you're saying is just as credible as what I'm saying. But the Bible says that we know for certain and understand that the world was made of things not seen by what? By faith. By faith. Now, faith is not blind here. It's not a cop-out. God is not copping out. But what he's saying, and we know that and experience it, if you claim Christ as your Savior and you have experienced conviction, you know what it is to have faith given to you. And what that means is this: Hebrews 11:1 says, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. We don't see God with our eyes. We don't see what happened in the very beginning. We see what we read here. But what confirms it that we really know for sure what has happened? It is the evidence that God gives to us. What evidence does God give us? He gives us the evidence of faith. Oh, faith is the evidence. So when we say, I have been given faith, I have been given what? Evidence. What kind of evidence? Spiritual evidence. Now, if you look at Romans chapter 1 here, Romans chapter 1 explains how to think about this. In Romans chapter 1, it says, in verse 16, for I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it's the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For therein is the righteousness, in the gospel message, is the righteousness of God revealed from what? Faith to faith. The evidence God gives to one man is the same evidence he gives to the next man and the next man and the next man. God is not changing the message or the evidence from one person to another. We are all given the same evidence from one person to another. God is confirming His Word in our hearts and making tangible and substantial that which otherwise would be beyond our grasp and our senses. And God places that within us, and when we experience it, we call it conviction. If you are a saved person, you have experienced what? Conviction. If you are a saved person, you have experienced God giving you the evidence that what you just heard is true and real. He has just confirmed it in your heart. If you reject the gospel, you have personally rejected God, and that removes the messenger out of the picture. You see the beauty of that? And this is the basis for condemnation before God, or His acceptance. Because when the messenger delivers the message, God personalizes it between the hearer and Himself with faith and says, I approve of this message. And then when you accept or reject, you are personally answering to God, not to the messenger. You see how that personal that becomes? And this is the basis. This is what God brings it down to when He's saying, I am giving you faith. I am giving you evidence. I'm confirming this between you and me. He says, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth and unrighteousness. It's confirmed by faith. Verse 19, because that which may be known of God is manifest, what? In them. That spiritual evidence, it's confirmed, it's manifested in them, for God hath showed it unto them. They know that. Verse 20. For the invisible things of Him from the what? Creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. All right. That brings up the second confirmation. God has given us faith, spiritual evidence, and physical evidence in creation. Because what God has designed in the physical world, the physical dimension around us, He has left His imprint, His ideas, His thought, His mind, His expression. What is going on in the mind of God has been expressed in creation. And that is how He is manifesting Himself. The invisible things of God are made clear and visible through the physical creation and manifestation of His thoughts. We call this world God's thoughts. It came from the mind of God. And so you see, God has given us spiritual evidence and He's given us physical evidence, and the two work together. So, going back to the question then, how do you know that what God says in Genesis chapter 1:1 is actually true? How do you know for sure? Well, you know for sure because of faith that confirms it, and you know it by the investigation of his imprint in the physical world. So we have the spiritual and the physical working together. All right, now, let's look at some of the empirical evidence. And Brother Bob, make sure this goes. Okay, good. Now, I'm going to give you some answers to questions. What I just gave you right now, the exercise, is a very important exercise because it helps us understand we don't have to rely on blind faith. And saying faith is not blindness. It's saying evidence. You can't prove your faith. You can't prove God's evidence in your heart to somebody else. I can't prove that I ate oatmeal last Monday. I can't prove that to anybody, but that doesn't mean it's not true. Your personalized experience between you and God is no less true because you can't prove it to someone. No one can take that personalized experience away from you. They can deny it all they want, but you know in your heart what's true, regardless of your ability to prove it to someone else. Creation's a different story. Creation is where we can all look at it together and rationally come to the same conclusion, which will verify what God has already told me personally, what has already told you personally, all right? There's a difference between the spiritual evidence and the physical evidence in that regard. The spiritual evidence personalizes it just between you and God. You can't prove that to anyone else, but you can come to a consensus in the physical world, the physical evidence. And I'm going to organize this information for you, which is very important. If you listen to creationists and evolutionists debate or you read materials, oftentimes what I found when I was going through this and starting to understand it, I was confused. And I was confused because the arguments and the evidences were not being appropriately organized and applied. And what we have is origin of the universe, origin of life, origin of species. These are the three categories that you want to keep in mind because the origin of the universe has its own set of evidences that are different from the evidences of origin of life, which has its own set of evidences that are different from the origin of species. You keep those separated when you read articles or hear people speak. If you know where to apply that evidence and that information, it will make sense to you. Otherwise, you'll be confused. Well, we're jumping around here. Let me see. All right. Now, here's the evidence that I'm going to show you briefly this morning. You can find more of this at my website, creationinsights.org. And you can read more articles. You can go to creation.com, which is Creation International's ministry. You can go to Answers in Genesis. Lots of information out there. But my particular niche and contribution to the whole debate of creation evolution is to organize material and show people how to use it appropriately and communicate it. So origin of the universe has the laws of thermodynamics. Origin of life has the origin of has the law of biogenesis, and origin of species has limited speciation argument. All right? So I already covered laws of thermodynamics, so we're going to breeze through this rather quickly. The first law of thermodynamics says that energy cannot create itself, period. It can't create itself. Now, there's different ways of referring to the first law of thermodynamics. Saying that nothing comes from nothing, something cannot come from nothing, or sometimes it's referred to as the conservation of energy, that whatever you put into a reaction, you can't have more or less coming out of the reaction. So there's this conservation. Whatever goes in has to come out. It has to be accounted for. In chemistry class, in chemistry laboratories, when they start students out, typically they'll have them start out with a weighed measurement of substance, some sort of a set of molecules, and then they'll have them dissolve them. Then they'll have them go through chemical reactions, and then they will go through a whole series of of changes of color and weights and all kinds of different sorts of chemical and physical changes. And then in the end, they will isolate and purify back to the original substance, and then they'll weigh it again. If you did your experiment correctly, you should end up with the same amount of material at the end after all that change as you started out with. Well, nobody ever does. You're always spilling something, but the concept's still there. Whatever goes in the reaction must come out. Now, everything we see in the world is energy. If you can weigh it, touch it, smell it, do anything to it, if you know it's there, it is a form of energy. But what does the first law of thermodynamics say? Energy cannot be created by natural means. If it can't be created by natural means, and that's all we see in the world, it's all energy, but it didn't get here by natural means. If it didn't get here naturally, it must have got here supernaturally. That's right. There's the question. It's just that simple. 1, 2, 3. You can knock that off. You've got a guaranteed argument in your favor. Why is that? A law of science. You can't get better than a law of science. Why? Because laws of science are irrefutable as of today. They're irrefutable. There's no known reason to not think that they're not right. They're 100% in their accuracy of predictions. They're 100% in their claims. There are no falsifications whatsoever. That's hardcore. Now, entropy, second law of thermodynamics, also known as entropy. Entropy, another word for entropy, would be chaos, disorganization. So entropy, if you keep that in mind, cannot reduce itself in a closed system by natural means. What that means is it can't organize itself. It's always going to tend to disorganization. Just go into any kid's, teenager's bedroom and you'll see what that entropy looks like. It keeps getting worse and worse and worse until you apply energy, an open system. You come in there and you put energy into it to organize it, and it always goes to entropy again. So the law of entropy is all about chaos, disorder, disorganization. That, in fact, is the law of entropy that prevents time machines. You can't have a time machine. Why? Because Humpty Dumpty can't put himself together. Water doesn't flow uphill. You can't reverse these things. Energy is always flowing downhill. It never goes uphill. So it is what they call the arrow of time. It keeps time going in one direction, and it can't be reversed. So when you look at the universe, you see a gigantic clock. Everything's moving. All the planets, all the galaxies swirling around, stars and swirling around, black holes. And you have this really highly organized, complex gear type operation going on in the universe. It's highly organized. But wait, the second law of thermodynamics says that energy can't organize itself by natural means. And yet that's what we see. If energy can't organize itself by natural means, then it must have been organized supernaturally. It's just that simple. Three-point argument. Second law of thermodynamics says energy can't organize itself naturally. Number two, we see the universe. It's highly organized. Number three, if it can't organize itself naturally, it must organize itself supernaturally. 3 points. Easy to grasp, right? So you can communicate that to someone. And that doesn't mean that someone's going to believe. I had a geneticist debate this point with me after a seminar for 2 hours. 2 hours. And it finally came down to saying, well, I see what you mean, but I can't accept it. All right, so because you have an argument and you can win that argument, have all the evidence on your side, does not mean that someone's going to agree with you. So don't be discouraged by it. And don't be discouraged by a comeback and a rebuttal, an answer. And I can't tell you all the multitudes of rebuttals you're going to hear, but I'm going to tell you, stay to the truth, stay to the 3 points. You can't lose this argument, no matter what the comeback is. And I've had some real doozies come back at me and just go, no, it's not going to work. So just stay on message. All right. Now, here's another law, and that is the law of biogenesis. We're shifting out of the law of, out of the origin of the universe now, and now we're into the origin of life. All right? We just shifted gears. I'm not using this as evidence for the origin of the universe. I'm using this as evidence for life. I'm keeping track of our organization material here. Now, the law of biogenesis out of the Helena Curtis textbook, Biology, second edition, published by Wirth, page 90, says where a cell exists, there must have been a pre-existing cell. Just as the animal arises only from an animal and the plant only from a plant. When's the last time you thought you'd ever see that in a biology textbook? We used that when I was teaching labs at the University of Arkansas. This was the textbook that was being used by the evolutionists. This textbook disappeared. I was doing a seminar called Evolution Dilemma at the University of Arkansas, and a zoology professor was there and some other faculty and some grad students. And while they were, while I was talking, she was sitting there in the audience, and just denying everything I said, and said, that's not evolution. And then she was challenging me on this, and I didn't have a picture of the book or a quote. I was reading it. And I said, well, Dr. Kramer, I'm taking this out of this book that you sat on the committee to approve. It got her. Never got her again. You know why? That's right. They censored the book. It was never seen again in a biology class at the University of Arkansas. And not only did they remove it from the biology classroom, they took it off the shelves in the library so no one would see it. This is the law of biogenesis. There's a lot to say about it, but the point is, just remember that the law of biogenesis is a law of science because it's never been refuted, and there's no reason to think that it will ever be refuted. Unless you're an evolutionist and you say, well, it can't be God, it can't be supernatural, so it has to be that life came from a lifeless molecule. What's your evidence? The law of biogenesis, spontaneous generation, was put to rest with the famous Louis Pasteur experiment with the swan neck flask. It was all put to rest. So anyway, that's so simple, isn't it? That's all you need to know, law of biogenesis. And just understand what it is. All cells come from pre-existing cells. Well, if this cell comes from this cell, from this cell, from this cell, it comes down to the first. Where'd the first cell come from? The first law of thermodynamics says it didn't pop out of lifeless molecules all by itself. All right, now, here's why we don't see that happening all by itself. I'm going to take you into the world of probabilities right now. I'm going to give you one probability. The chance of a living cell coming into being by pure chance is 10 to the 340th millionth power. This is hard to conceive of. We don't think exponentially. We think linearly. We think, okay, 340,000 or 340 million or 340 billion. I mean, that's easy to conceive of. This is impossible to conceive of, and I'll show you why it's impossible. One in 10 to the 340th millionth power. Now, that's the probability that it would happen. Well, what we can say is that's the absurdly impossible. It is absolutely not going to happen. That's why the law of biogenesis exists. The probabilities show us why life cannot come from lifeless molecules. Because 10 to the 50th, Ernst Borel here, a French mathematician, calculated that mathematically the number for impossibility is at the threshold of 1 to 10 to the 50th power. How does 10 to the 50th power compare to 10 to the 340th millionth power? You're way beyond impossibility mathematically. That's 1 with 50 zeros. That's 100,000 billion, 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 billion. I mean, there's no way to describe the absurdity. It's not going to happen. Now, how many subatomic particles? We're not talking about how many stars in the galaxy. We're not talking about how many molecules. We're not talking about how many atoms in the entire universe. We're talking about how many subatomic particles that make up all the atoms in the universe. It's the number 10 to the 80th. And you say, that just seems too small. No, that's how big that number is. You see, we're not accustomed to thinking 10 to any exponent number. 10 to the 80th power is just that big. There are 10 to the 80th numbers of subatomic particles that make up the Earth, the Sun, Venus, Jupiter, Saturn, the galaxies, every planet, everything that exists in the entire universe. It's all made up of that number of subatomic particles. And we're talking about the chance formation calculated by an evolutionist, Morowitz, Dr. Morowitz. 10 to the 340th millionth power. It's not going to happen. And yet people still try to come up with theories and argue the case that life happened anyway from lifeless molecules. Well, there's an organization called Original Life Foundation, which you want to become familiar with. Why? Because they're offering $1 million, or I should say they did offer $1 million, to anyone who could offer a plausible explanation. I want you to catch that. A plausible explanation. You didn't have to demonstrate it in the laboratory. You didn't have to prove it. You didn't have to give any evidence. All you had to do was demonstrate on a piece of paper, writing it down on with a pen. This is a plausible explanation of how life could come into being from lifeless molecules. That Origin of Life Foundation is an evolutionary group. They were trying to promote the investigation and really make a contest out of it. Thought, boy, people will jump on the bandwagon and really come up with a plausible theory of how all this could happen. And they were incentivizing everyone with $1 million prize for anyone who could offer a plausible explanation. Well, a couple of years ago, they closed down the competition. Oh, you can still find the organization and you can still read about the prize on the internet, the Original Life Foundation. And I always like to tell people, when you come across someone who says, absolutely, it happened this way, life came from lifeless molecules, tell them, hey, go get your $1 million. Or ask them, who claimed the $1 million? Nobody. And it's not because no one produced life in the laboratory. It's because no one could even come up with a plausible explanation. All right? And that's not under the scrutiny of creationists. That's under the scrutiny of evolutionists. All right. So what I've given you there to make your case, when you're talking to someone who is a skeptic, who believes that, yes, life could come from lifeless molecules, remember the law of biogenesis. And then you can explain the law of probabilities is just so astronomical. It just can't happen. That's why there's a law of biogenesis. And in fact, the attempts to produce life in the laboratory has so dismally failed. They can't even come up with a plausible explanation for it. And the $1 million offered by the Original Life Foundation has never been claimed. There. You just nailed the origin of the universe and irrefutably argued for a supernatural origin of the universe and energy. You have just seen irrefutable evidence for the origin of life by creation, supernaturally. Are you beginning to feel equipped? I mean, and it's not complicated. You can offer that to someone, can't you? And you might have children or grandchildren who need to hear this, and you can offer that to them. Let's look at species. And species has always been the stronghold of evolutionists. So when you hear a creation-evolution debate, the creationist typically is going to start out with the origin of the universe and work forward and argue precedents. The evolutionist is going to start out with speciation and work backwards. Why? Because they have mechanisms of change. Well, it's not they. The creationists have the same mechanisms. Mutation and natural selection happens. What that means is the DNA, the code molecule that codes for life, changes. That's no big deal. I did that in my laboratory for a couple of years. I was bombarding bacteria with radiation and nicking and causing all kinds of mutations and changes in the bacteria, and then studying the changes that occurred in them. That's not a big deal. Natural selection pressures, we see natural selection pressures. We can see how that operates and separates like a bird population. If there's a forest fire, half a bird population can fly south, half of them fly north, and they never see each other again. Some of the birds going north are carrying genes that the birds going south don't have anymore. They didn't carry that gene with them, and vice versa. And so they're carrying genes. So that's how genes get separated. Anyway, it's quite an interesting study. But it has nothing to do with ongoing evolution. Nothing. We're not even talking about microevolution. Don't even use the word. Why? Because as soon as you use the word evolution, micro or otherwise, mini micro or really mini, mini micro, as soon as you use that word, they take an inch and they go a mile with it. Now, what it is, we're talking about variation and adaptation within a defined species. That's what we're talking about. Variation and adaptability are the two words you use. You don't use microevolution, because these are not honest and rational people. They are not interested in a truth dialogue. They're only interested in winning an argument. So you use adaptability and variation. That's all you use. And eliminate evolution out of your vocabulary altogether. It's loaded. It's loaded with baggage. That is a word that has been spun so much. I'll just tell you. As I was, I talked to a zoology professor in her office one day, and I was setting up a debate, creation conference at the university. Dr. Gish wanted me to ask Dr. Kramer to debate. And when I presented the idea, she said, "That's unethical. Debates are unethical." But it wasn't unethical for her, and this is why Dr. Gish had asked for her. He said, it wasn't unethical when I was down in Hot Springs to blast me in the newspaper after I left and debate me after I couldn't give an answer. But now it's unethical to debate him on the stage face to face. I mean, I'm telling you, it has nothing to do with ethics. It's all about saving their own skin and being able to perpetuate lies without ever having to give an answer, an honest answer. So this is the crowd we're dealing with. Now, what it comes down to when we're dealing with the issue of speciation, there is horizontal or limited change that takes place, change within a given species. Within the human population, we see a lot of variation and adaptability. Hey, it exists. Same way with dogs. I mean, you look at the little Chihuahua, you look at the big Great Dane, everything in between. There's a lot of variation that God has created and designed into the DNA code. And so that is something a part of design. That's not by accident. It's part of design. And variation can occur, but it has definite boundaries to it. So it is limited variation. Whereas the evolutionists are claiming it's unlimited change, evolution from single cell, from the Big Bang, single cell, to all the different types of species in the world. So they're arguing the case of unlimited. Now, the question then is not, does change occur? The question is, how much change occurs? That's the big point to remember when you are arguing, debating, or discussing the issue of speciation. Now, the fruit fly, Drosophila melanogaster, the big name, the little fly with the big name, here is is the classic genetic animal model. It's been bombarded with mutational radiation for millions and millions of generations. We're talking about hundreds of millions of generations of flies. Not hundreds of millions of flies. We're talking about hundreds of millions of generations of flies. And they're still fruit flies. The evolutionists had held out hope that the fruit fly would demonstrate evolution in the laboratory. It did not. And what they found out was, we clearly see that the limits of variation appear. This is an evolutionist. This is out of the evolutionary journals. It appears to be narrowly bounded and often bounded within the species. All right? This was the conclusion that they came to. Now, this is the evidence. This is laboratory evidence that you are using to answer the question, how much change? Now, what is the evidence that change is limited versus unlimited? All of the evidence, 100% of the evidence, is limited change. The fruit fly is the best information that you've got, the best evidence. Now, here's why this is so. It's because of some research that Dr. John Sanford has come out with recently in the last 10 years. 2007 with the ENCODE project that went through the internet and got amateur and professionals working on the genetic human genome. Dr. Sanford, he's also credited and known for inventing the genetic gun. He's a botanist. He's a genetic engineer. He has developed a computer simulation where you can input all the variables for adaptation and variation, mutation, natural selection pressures. He put it all together into a model called the Mendel's Accountant. You can get it online. You can download the program free, and you can play with it yourself and see the simulation of mutations that occur over long periods of time. And what he found out here was, when subjected to only natural forces, the human genome must irrevocably degenerate over time. What that means, and what he calls this, is genomic entropy. Remember that word, entropy? Has nothing to do with the origin of the universe. We're talking about species. We're talking about the genetic molecule. That over time, millions and millions of events, what they call copy events, are going on in every one of your cells right now. Millions of copying results. And the DNA molecule in every cell of your body is being used, copied, and transcribed. Along with those millions, there are millions of copy errors being made, mistakes taking place, mutations. But because the way the DNA, the cells are designed, God has designed it with repair mechanisms, and all those millions of changes and mutations in your cells are being fixed. Now, not all the fixes are there, so ultimately about 100 to 200 on average mutations are slip through the repair cracks, and you're carrying about 100 to 200 mutations in your body right now. And what that means is, when you have children, you are passing on 100 to 200 mutations to your children, which means they have about, let's just say, 100 more mutations than you have. You have 100 more mutations than your parents have. They have 100 more mutations than your great-grandparents, and so on and so on. You are a mutant. Now, how many generations can the human population endure with this accumulation of degeneration, genomic degeneration, where we are genetically altered and mutating, and then they have to compare beneficial versus deleterious, harmful. Guess what? The deleterious mutations occur at a greater frequency than beneficial. And what his research and program, you can download it, is showing that all organisms are headed towards extinction, not evolution. Extinction, not improvement. That is why we see in the fruit fly, it's not going anywhere. And what the evolutionists have said, well, it's at a dead end of the phylogenetic tree. How do we know that? Because it's not becoming anything. How do we know it's not becoming anything else? Because it's at the dead end. How do we know it's at the dead end? Because it's not becoming anything else. And how do we know it's not becoming anything else? Because it's at the dead end. It's just going around. If it's meaningless argument. All right, here's the bottom line. If creation science is correct, then the Bible is right. If the Bible is right, then there really was an Adam and Eve. If there was an Adam and Eve, then there really is sin. If there's sin, there is judgment. And if there is judgment, we need a Savior. You see, everything we do is for the point and goal of getting souls saved. Because Satan, our arch enemy in the world, is trying to blind the hearts and minds of those lest they see the light of the glorious gospel. And evolution is one of those tactics to blind people. And the question we have to leave with people, and I leave with you, do you know Christ is your Savior? There's no reason not to. Amen?